Terrible Tommy here in the bunker with Lone Wolf Radio.
That microphone might work a little better if I get it up off the floor. Jeez, what a half-ass operation we got here. I don't have my engineer is quite a few miles away, so it's a little difficult. So if I screw up, screw you, man. I don't care. Well, I do care, but hey, it's Friday, Freya's Day, and I had a song on here, and I had half a show done, and as usual, I pressed the wrong button, and I lost half a show. So, you know, this is the place where we talk about the N-word, we talk about the H-word, and we talk about the R-word, and we talk a lot about a lot of words, but the one we like the most is the H-word. Did I say that, H-word? Guess what that means, H-word. It is the 14th of April, 2017, Freya's Day. And this show goes out to all the she-wolves out there, Radio Land, right. So since I lost half a show and I don't have time to do it over, I owe you half a show about the military over there in Afghanistan. I'll dig it out tomorrow. No, that's Saturday. I'll dig it out Monday. Yeah. So for today, we're going to dig out another expose on your favorite subject, rotten, corrupt, traitorous bastards in Washington.
Exclusive. Despite evidence that Al-Qaeda and its allies have staged fake chemical attacks in Syria before, official Washington asserts with high confidence that it's not being fooled again, reports Robert Perry. By Robert Perry in official Washington, words rarely mean what they say. For instance, if a United States government official voices high confidence in a supposed intelligence assessment, that usually means we don't have any real evidence, but we figure that if we say high confidence enough that no one will dare challenge us. Donald Trump speaking with the media at a hangar at Mesa Gateway Airport in Mesa, Arizona. December 16, 2015. Flicker Gage Skidmore. It's also true that after a the United States president or another senior official jumps to a conclusion that is not supported by evidence, the ranks of government careerists will close around him or her, making any serious or objective investigation almost impossible. Plus, if the dubious allegations are directed at some enemy state, then the mainstream media also will suppress skepticism. Prestigious news outlets will run fact checks filled with words in capital letters, misleading, false, or maybe fake news. Which is where things stand regarding President Trump's rush to judgment within hours about an apparent chemical weapons incident in Syria's Idlib province on April 4th. Despite the fact that much of the information was coming from Al-Qaeda and its propaganda-savvy allies, the mainstream the United States media rushed emotional images onto what Trump calls the shows upon which he says he bases his foreign policy judgments, and he blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad for the scores of deaths, including beautiful little babies, as Trump declared. Given the neocon-slash-liberal interventionist domination of official Washington's foreign policy and the professional Western propaganda shops working for Assad's overthrow, there was virtually no pushback against the quick formulation of this new groupthink. All the predictable players played their predictable parts, from the New York Times to CNN to the Atlantic Council-related Bellingcat and its citizen journalists. All the important people who appeared on the TV shows or who were quoted in the mainstream media trusted the images provided by Al-Qaeda-related propagandists and ignored documented prior cases in which the Syrian rebels staged chemical weapons incidents to implicate the Assad government. We all know, one smug CNN commentator pontificated, we all know what happened in 2013, a reference to the enduring conventional wisdom that an August 21, 2013 sarin attack outside Damascus was carried out by the Assad government and that President Obama then failed to enforce his red line against chemical weapons use. This beloved groupthink survives even though evidence later showed the operation was carried out by rebels, most likely by Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front with help from Turkish intelligence, as investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reported and brave Turkish officials later confirmed. President Obama in the Oval Office. But official Washington's resistance to reality was perhaps best demonstrated 1 year ago when The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg published a detailed article about Obama's foreign policy that repeated the groupthink about Obama shrinking from his red line but included the disclosure that Director of National Intelligence James Clapper had informed the president that the United States intelligence lacked any slam-dunk evidence that Assad's military was guilty. One might normally think that such a warning from DNI Clapper would have spared Obama from the media's judgment that he had chickened out, especially given the later evidence pointing the finger of blame at the rebels. After all, why should Obama have attacked the Syrian military and killed large numbers of soldiers and possibly civilians in retaliation for a crime that they had nothing to do with and indeed an offense for which the Assad government was being framed? But official Washington's propaganda bubble is impervious to inconvenient reality. Nor does anyone seem to know that a United Nations report disclosed testimonies from eyewitnesses about how rebels and their allied rescue workers had staged one chlorine attack so it would be blamed on the Assad government. Besides these Syrians coming forward to expose the fraud, the evidence that had been advanced to prove Assad's guilt included bizarre claims from the rebels and their friends that they could tell that chlorine was inside a barrel bomb because of the special sound that it made while it was descending. Despite the exposure of that one frame-up, the UN investigators, under intense pressure from Western governments to give them something to pin on the Assad regime, accepted rebel claims about two other alleged chlorine attacks, an implausible finding that is now repeatedly cited by the Western media even as it ignores the case of the debunked chlorine attack. Again, one might think that proof of two staged chemical weapons attacks, one involving sarin and the other chlorine, would inject some skepticism about the April 4th case, but apparently not. All that was left was for President Trump to act presidential and fire off 59 Tomahawk missiles at some Syrian airbase on April 6, reportedly killing several Syrian soldiers and 9 civilians, including 4 children, collateral damage that the mainstream the United States media knows not to mention in its hosannas of praise for Trump's decisiveness. Home free groupthink. There might be some pockets of resistance to the groupthink among professional analysts at the CIA, but their findings, if they contradict what the president has already done, will be locked away probably for generations, if not forever. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In other words, the new Assad did it groupthink appeared to be home free, a certainty that the New York Times could now publish without having to add annoying words like alleged or possibly, simply stating Assad's guilt as flat fact. Thomas L. Friedman, the Times Star foreign policy columnist, did that and then extrapolated from his certainty to propose that the United States should ally itself with the jihadists fighting to overthrow Assad, a position long favored by the United States allies, Saudi Arabia and Israel. Why should our goal right now be to defeat the Islamic State in Syria? Friedman asked before proposing outright support for the jihadists. We could dramatically increase our military aid to anti-Assad rebels, giving them sufficient anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to threaten Russian, Iranian, Hezbollah and Syrian helicopters and fighter jets and make them bleed, may be enough to want to open negotiations. Fine with me. So, not only have the mainstream the United States media stars decided that they know what happened on April 4th in a remote Al-Qaeda-controlled section of Idlib province, without seeing any real evidence, but they are now building off their groupthink to propose that the Trump administration hand out anti-aircraft missiles to the anti-Assad rebels who, in reality, are under the command of Al-Qaeda and / or the Islamic State. In other words, Friedman and other deep thinkers are advocating material support for terrorists who would get sophisticated American ground-to-air missiles that could shoot down Russian planes, thus exacerbating already dangerous U.S. Russian tensions, or take down some civilian airliner as Al-Qaeda has done in the past. If someone named Abdul had made such a suggestion, he could expect a knock on his door from the FBI. Expert skepticism yet, before President Trump takes Friedman's advice, arming up Al-Qaeda and entering into a de facto alliance with Islamic State, we might want to make sure that we aren't being taken in again by a clever Al-Qaeda psychological operation, another staged chemical weapons attack. New York Times columnist Thomas L. Friedman. With the United States intelligence community effectively silenced by the fact that the president has already acted, Theodore Postol, a technology and national security expert at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, undertook his own review of the supposed evidence cited by Trump's White House to issue a four-page intelligence assessment on April 11, asserting with high confidence that Assad's military delivered a bomb filled with sarin on the town of Khan Sheikhoun on the morning of April 4. Postol, whose analytical work helped debunk official Washington's groupthink regarding the 2013 sarin attack outside Damascus, expressed new shock at the shoddiness of the latest White House report, or where. Postol produced a quick turnaround assessment of the April 11 report that night and went into greater detail in an addendum on April 13, writing, "This addendum provides data that unambiguously shows that the assumption in the where that there was no tampering with the alleged site of the sarin release is not correct. This egregious error raises questions about every other claim in the where. The implication of this observation is clear: the where was not reviewed and released by any competent intelligence expert unless they were motivated by factors other than concerns about the accuracy of the report. Photograph of men in Khan Sheikhoun in Syria, allegedly inside a crater where a sarin gas bomb landed. The where also makes claims about communications intercepts which supposedly provide high confidence that the Syrian government was the source of the attack. There is no reason to believe that the veracity of this claim is any different from the now verified false claim that there was unambiguous evidence of a sarin release at the cited crater. The evidence that unambiguously shows that the assumption that the sarin release crater was tampered with is contained in six photographs at the end of this document." Postol notes that one key photo shows a man standing in the alleged sarin release crater. He is wearing a honeycomb face mask that is designed to filter small particles from the air. Other apparel on him is an open-necked cloth shirt and what appear to be medical exam gloves. Two other men are standing in front of him, on the left in the photograph, also wearing honeycomb face masks and medical exam gloves. If there were any sarin present at this location when this photograph was taken, everybody in the photograph would have received a lethal or debilitating dose of sarin. The fact that these people were dressed so inadequately either suggests a complete ignorance of the basic measures needed to protect an individual from sarin poisoning, or that they knew that the site was not seriously contaminated. This is the crater that is the centerpiece evidence provided in the where for a sarin attack delivered by a Syrian aircraft. No competent analyst, after reviewing other discrepancies in photos of the crater, Postol wrote, "It is hard for me to believe that anybody competent could have been involved in producing the Ware report, and the implications of such an obviously predetermined result strongly suggests that this report was not motivated by a serious analysis of any kind." Another photo of the crater containing the alleged canister that supposedly dispersed sarin in Khan Sheikhoun, Syria, on April 4, 2017. This finding is disturbing. It indicates that the Ware was probably a report purely aimed at justifying actions that were not supported by any legitimate intelligence. This is not a unique situation. President George W. Bush has argued that he was misinformed about unambiguous evidence that Iraq was hiding a substantial amount of weapons of mass destruction. This false intelligence led to the United States attack on Iraq that started a process that ultimately led to a political disintegration in the Middle East, which through a series of unpredicted events then led to the rise of the Islamic State. Postol continued, on August 30, 2013, the White House under President Obama produced a similarly false report about the nerve agent attack on August 21, 2013 in Damascus. This report also contained numerous intelligence claims that could not be true. An interview with President Obama published in The Atlantic in April 2016 indicates that Obama was initially told that there was solid intelligence that the Syrian government was responsible for the nerve agent attack of August 21, 2013 in Ghouta, Syria. Obama reported that he was later told that the intelligence was not solid by the then Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. Equally serious questions are raised about the abuse of intelligence findings by the incident in 2013. Questions that have not been answered about that incident is how the White House produced a false intelligence report with false claims that could obviously be identified by experts outside the White House and without access to classified information. There also needs to be an explanation of why this 2013 false report was not corrected. It is now obvious that a second incident similar to what happened in the Obama administration has now occurred in the Trump administration. In this case, the president, supported by his staff, made a decision to launch 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian air base. This action was accompanied by serious risks of creating a confrontation with Russia, and also undermining cooperative efforts to win the war against the Islamic State. I therefore conclude that there needs to be a comprehensive investigation of these events that have either misled people in the White House, or worse yet, been perpetrated by people seeking to force decisions that were not justified by the cited intelligence. This is a serious matter and should not be allowed to continue. While Postol's appeal for urgent attention to this pattern of the White House making false intelligence claims now implicating three successive administrations makes sense, the likelihood of such an undertaking is virtually nil. The embarrassment and loss of credibility for not only the United States political leadership but the major United States news outlets would be so severe, especially in the wake of the WMD fiasco in Iraq, that no establishment figure or organization would undertake such a review. Instead, official Washington's propaganda bubble will stay firmly in place, allowing its inhabitants to go happily about their business, believing that they are the caretakers of truth.
The war crimes go on and on and on and on. But they come together so fast now that you forget about them before the next one. Benghazi, all these things, you know, all the stuff that happened, plus 9/11. They forget things. They want you to forget things. Now I'll see whether I can find the last half of that show I was doing on the deaths and the blaming it on everybody else over there in Afghanistan that I was playing yesterday.
True about Afghanistan, that it was so much has been selectively reported to fit media narratives and people don't really know the truth.
Absolutely. So this book, Dog Company, is full of examples of that and full of examples of a lot of the politically driven rules of engagement type stuff that we just talked about over the last 5-10 minutes. There's a story in the book, one of the chapters about 2/3 of the way in, where we receive an SOS call from a New York National Guard unit that gets caught up in a valley called Tangi Valley. And we had this sort of IM chat capability from vehicle to vehicle. And so these guys are about 45 minutes away in this sub-valley. And we get this SOS chat, you know, hey, we're in trouble. Come give us a hand if you're nearby or available. So we load up, move out to those guys, unexpected, you know, not expecting to do so on that day because we had other operations going on. We show up. Their vehicles are burned through the asphalt into the bedrock. There are uniform items strewn about the battlefield. There's shell casings all over the place. And soon after, a special operations unit shows up on the ground with pictures of two guys and says, hey, we've got two New York National Guardsmen missing in action right now. We got to go find their bodies. We're not sure if they're dead or alive. So that mission turns into a hunt, a search, right, for these two guys. Long story short, we find our unit, my guys, Dog Company, finds one of the guys in a field some distance away. His arms had been hacked off.
Oh, my gosh.
He's naked, right? His uniform has been ripped off. His heart has been cut out, or at least that's what we suspect, because there was a hole in his chest right where his heart should be. And at this point in time, we had a lot of assets in the air, and we were getting reports that his fingers were being sold in the local bazaars as war trophies.
My goodness.
And my guys are the guys on the ground that are sifting through all this crap. And I find out some number of weeks later that what's reported in the AP is that three National Guard soldiers killed in action in Afghanistan in this area. Here are their ages. Here are their ranks. Here are their names. Killed in an IED ambush. End of story. No further comment. So part of the problem here is that the American people don't know what we're up against. They don't know how barbaric and savage the enemy that we're dealing with is. And the government has been hiding this from us. And so it really changes your perspective when you understand what you're really dealing with. It changes the sense of urgency that you have. It changes what you're willing to do to overcome such a barbaric enemy. But unfortunately, the American people have had a lot of this stuff repressed and hidden from them.
And now you've shifted your focus, especially with this book, to trying to get some of the lawyers out of these incredibly complex situations for national security with people in combat, trying to get the PC-ification of the military that really was escalated rapidly under President Obama, trying to undo some of that. Who are some of the heroes and villains, people who have come to your aid, who have given you platforms, who have advocated for you? Who are the people who you really think are trying to push the military into a more PC, more lawyered up place where people like you, the real experts, are not trusted to do their jobs?
Well, I think the last administration is a good example of the type of mindset and people that have pushed us more in the direction of being too PC and over-politicizing the military and the government at large. The folks that have been advocates and have really come to the aid of Dog Company and other stories like ours are folks like United American Patriots. They're an organization that is working to push the current administration and has for past administrations to conduct full reviews of the United Military Code of Justice to review the laws of warfare versus the rule of law, which is what we're trying to push overseas. You can't fight a counterinsurgency. You can't fight combat with the same rules and restrictions that you police your own first world country with. And so there's an inevitable conflict there between what we should be subscribing to in terms of law of warfare, which gives commanders a lot more latitude on the battlefield to discern and make decisions that they need to, given the real realities on the ground, versus trying to push this agenda of, hey, we rule with police in a, you know, a highly progressive Western civilization. Let's try to apply that rule of law to a, you know, a fifth or sixth world country. It just doesn't work. So this group, UAP, has done a great job of trying to push for those types of reforms in our military code of justice and within how the government just views how we apply the law of warfare to today's conflicts.
Now, we were talking during the break, and you actually mentioned that the government has tried to prevent the book from making publication. That is shocking to me. Who did this? And give us some more details on that.
Yeah, so there's a case that's central to this book. This book is it's tragic, but it's also, unfortunately, very entertaining. The feedback we've gotten is that when people pick it up from the first chapter, they can't put it down. And the reason for that is it has a number of really neat elements to it. One, it's sort of a cross between A Band of Brothers and that sort of combat action and brotherhood, and then also it ends and sort of culminates with a court hearing, if you will, action. So sort of a cross between Band of Brothers and A Few Good Men. The case central to the story was kicked off by an investigation which led to a hearing. The findings to that investigation and hearing, an Article 32 hearing for those of your audience that are familiar with military law, was the findings were written by an investigating officer who sort of serves as a judge over what's the equivalent to a civilian grand jury proceeding. My higher command at that time fought to, and I didn't know this, but they conspired to make that set of findings, and I'm using air quotes here, an incomplete record through a technicality to make it unavailable through the Freedom of Information Act to the American public. So from the very beginning, the findings were stifled and masked by the government to try to prevent the American public from knowing what really happened to Dog Company in Afghanistan 2008-2009. If you flip through the book, you'll notice that there are a number of redactions in the book. We submitted the book for review to the Office of Security Review at the Pentagon. They advertise that they can turn a book around in a month. They've got a whole office and staff of people dedicated to doing this. They got back to us once they received the book and said, hey, your book's a little long. Our book's about 420 pages. It's got a bit of a presence to it. And they said it's going to take us 2 months. It took them a year to get their review done. And when we got the book back, by that point in time, we had hired subject matter experts in counterintel and intelligence to review it, and they argued that 90% of the redactions that the government had made were already in federally funded websites.
This just shows you how widespread the corruption is. What an important book. Captain Roger Hill, thanks for joining me in studio on Breitbart News Daily.
Well, there's the other half, or the other third of that interview that we brought you yesterday, so if you missed it yesterday, go back there and listen to that and then listen to this, and you've got the whole interview, which is pretty self-explanatory. What we've got here is treason in high places, as always. Like I said yesterday, we had it in Vietnam, Korea, World War II. It's nothing new for the military-industrial complex to turn on their own, eat their own. Yeah, so I hope that's a good suggestion that you do not run off and join the military. Or at least don't join the military in any type situation where you're going to get into active fighting over in these places. But, you know, this reminds me, he was talking about the mutilation of the bodies. I was to a skinhead concert, and I forget where it was, way back. And I was going to take this kid down to catch a train or a plane or something. And we were riding along in a car, and he had something around his neck. And I said, what do you got there? And he said, well, that's a, what was it, a nose or a finger that he cut off a guy in Iraq. And he was proudly wearing it around. So almost all soldiers, or at least some of all soldiers, do participate in that type of activity. So anyhow, that's the story there. But I don't see much more worse of planes and drones dropping bombs and bunker busters and all that kind of stuff on civilians, killing thousands of kids, wiping out all their houses and everything else, than a rebel on the ground using whatever weapon he's got to kill his enemy. I mean, I have a problem. I mean, you know, for one side saying, oh, how terrible they were, how terrible those guys are, when what they're doing is, to me, even worse. I remember sitting in a restaurant one time, I talked about this on the radio, a couple of guys were sitting over there, older guys, bragging about flying B-17s over Germany, dropping tons and tons of bombs on working class neighborhoods, not the headquarters of the National Socialists or anything like that. They were bombing working class neighborhoods on purpose. That was a part of the war, to destroy common people, to make them rebel against the leaders. What chance would they have? What chance would the Germans, even if they wanted to have rebelled against the high command? So this, I'm telling you, this is the way it goes. I don't want to hear anybody talking about Holocaust anymore. From now on, it's the N-word. H-word, I'm sorry. The H-word, and then for nigger, we got the N-word, and then for retard, we got the R-word, and I forget what else. Well, I'll figure out some more, too. I'm going to cut it off a little sooner today than normal because I've been working all afternoon and part of the morning writing letters and getting caught up on my mail, and I got a lot of prisoner mail and all that kind of stuff. And I was behind on my money orders to some of the POWs. I had to do all that. So I'm pooped. So when I get pooped, I'm going to quit. I'll see you tomorrow. No, not tomorrow. Monday. What the hell? Here's another one for the she-wolves out there.
Lord knows I am peaceful when I'm left alone. I've always been an eagle, been a while since I have flown. My claws are sharp as ever, so my eagle eye. Something's gonna go to ground when the eagle flies. Lately I've heard rumors that the eagle may be lame. Just because I've been idle don't mean that I'm tame. Jeopardize my freedom, my natural place to roost. I can fly when I have to. They turn the eagle loose. So lay all your doubts aside when you go to bed tonight. My feathers are all ruffled now. I'm ready for a fight. Just because I took a while to fly, I don't mean I don't care. When you feel the shadow crossing, eagles in the air. So lay all your doubts aside when you go to bed tonight. My feathers are all ruffled now. I'm ready for a fight. Just because I took a while to fly, I don't mean I don't care. When you feel the shadow crossing, the eagle's in the air. When you feel the shadow crossing,